I'm posting this short, maybe 20-minute podcast to keep us somewhat on pace with our syllabus and to help you get set up for some discussions we'll have Friday and next Monday, and for our guest speaker who's going to come in next Wednesday to talk about echocardiography. And before we get into some new material, I wanted to point your attention to the website where I've added some new links to a YouTube channel which will contain the videos that I showed you in the last class, and then a link under reading and listening assignments for Friday to a video that some of you in the second lab saw on Monday of the path of blood through the heart that I think will help you review the chambers and the valves and some of the material that we did in lab, and that's going to be very helpful as we go into Friday's lecture, Monday's lecture, and our guest speaker next week. So please check that out. And if you haven't yet, use your cadaver CD to look for animations of heart contractions and blood movement, and I think that'll be very helpful for you too. Your goal really for next week, by Monday and Wednesday of next week, is to have a really good solid foundational understanding of how blood flows through a heart, what the valves are doing, which valves are where, and what are the major blood vessels. And we'll review that really briefly in this short podcast as a review, because you saw all that in lab on Monday. And what else do I have on here? Thursday's quiz. So Thursday night from 6 p.m. to 1 a.m. Friday morning, you'll have available to you the online quiz on ANGEL. You'll have 30 minutes to take it. So once you log in and start taking it, you'll have 30 minutes. It's open book, open notes, but it needs to be done individually. So once you've started taking the quiz, no discussing anything about the quiz. Obviously, you can study together beforehand, but once you start taking it, it's a solo affair. So let's talk about some new material and where we left off at the end of Monday's lecture. We talked about the components of blood, and the next thing I wanted to talk about was anemia. And anemia is having too few red blood cells or not enough hemoglobin. Either way, it means that you can't carry sufficient amounts of oxygen in the body. And there are three main ways that anemia can take place. The most obvious is that you're bleeding. You're bleeding and you're losing blood volume. You're losing red blood cells along with the hemoglobin within them. And the response to this is for your spleen, which stores red blood cells, to release more into your cardiovascular system, into your blood vessels, and to start increasing the production of red blood cells. And hopefully this will make you think of the hormone that tells your red bone marrow to make more red blood cells and the organs that release that hormone. Right, that hormone's erythropoietin, and erythropoietin is secreted by the liver and by the kidneys. It stimulates your red bone marrow to make more red blood cells. So bleeding is one source of anemia. So not losing it, losing the blood cells from your body will cause anemia. Having those red blood cells be destroyed is another cause of anemia. They don't have to leave the body. They could be destroyed by venoms, so it's going to be animal venoms, drug reactions. There's some bad drug reactions that can cause destruction of red blood cells. Malaria, the protistin parasite that you pick up from mosquitoes that causes malaria, destroys red blood cells, and those all cause anemia. So you cannot, you could have them be destroyed, or you cannot make enough. Inadequate erythropoiesis, that can cause anemia as well. That's often due to damage or some disease of the kidneys. Kidneys are a significant site for production of erythropoietin, and if you have kidney disease, you don't make enough erythropoietin, you don't stimulate enough red blood cell production, and that can make you anemic. So anemia is one of the symptoms of kidney disease. What are the effects of anemia? Well, it helps make, or it causes hypoxia in your tissues, insufficient amounts of oxygen. Your tissues literally don't get enough oxygen. It can also cause edema in the tissues, and this is due to the reduced osmolarity of the blood. What does that mean? Well, if you don't have as many red blood cells and you don't have as much hemoglobin in your blood, there's less stuff dissolved in the fluid of your blood. The water concentration goes up, the concentration of solutes goes down, and that causes fluids to come out of your blood from the capillary beds into the surrounding tissues. The surrounding tissues swell up with fluid, and that's edema. And that's a concept that we're going to talk about more when we get into capillary beds and what causes the movement of fluids in and out of capillary beds. So we'll come back to that one. Anemia can also cause drops in blood pressure, especially if you're bleeding and losing blood volume, your blood pressure will go down. There's a separate type of anemia that's worth talking about, and that's sickle cell anemia. And this is an anemia that's a genetic disorder, not due to bleeding or inadequate erythropoiesis. Sickle cell anemia is caused by a mutation in one of the genes that produces one of the two hemoglobin proteins that come together to produce that four-part hemoglobin molecule that we use in our red blood cells. And people who carry this mutation, if they have two copies of this mutation, two copies of this abnormal gene, under low oxygen conditions, their red blood cells assume this weird shape. And you can see that in the lower left-hand panel. Those are three normal red blood cells and one sickle-shaped red blood cell. And you can see some of those in the micrograph on the right as well. These sickle-shaped red blood cells get stuck in capillary beds and impair blood flow and cause what are called sickle cell crises, inadequate blood flow to parts of the body. These can be very, very painful, very, very dangerous, can be fatal, and that's due to this abnormal hemoglobin. Now, if you only have one version of this sickle cell allele, of the sickle cell gene, you get a milder version of sickle cell anemia that doesn't cause fatalities, doesn't interfere with your ability to grow up and reproduce, doesn't limit the spread of this gene, and that's the reason why this gene is probably still in the human population, is that you have to have two of them for it to impair your reproductive output. With only one copy, you reproduce fine, and you have some complications, but you get a major benefit, which is that having one of these sickle cell alleles, not two, but having one of them, allows you to reproduce. Gene gets passed on and gives you a lot of protection against malaria. So the malaria parasite is not as able to infect people who have this unusual version of hemoglobin. And so it would make sense that you find the sickle cell allele more often where you have high amounts of malaria. And that's definitely the case. So this mutant version of the hemoglobin allele evolved in Africa, and it's been maintained in human populations for thousands of years due to its ability to help people, keep people from being infected with the malarial parasite. Blood typing. Next topic in the notes is blood typing. We've done this in lab, so I'm not going to spend too much time, or really any time, talking about it here. We'll have time to review that later on, maybe Friday or Monday or next week's labs. The concept that antibodies in the blood can recognize antigens and cause agglutination of red blood cells, which can plug up blood vessels and lead to impaired blood flow. What we didn't talk about, which we will talk about, I think, on Friday when we get back together, is the impact on the Rh factor in women during pregnancy. And I think I alluded to this in lab, but we hadn't really talked about it. And this is a complication for women who are Rh negative, who don't have the Rh antigen, who have an Rh positive fetus. And so we'll save this topic, and we'll talk about it on Friday when we can do it face to face. The other thing we did in lab was look at different types of white blood cells. At least those of you in the early lab did, those of you in the later lab did not. So some of you will be looking at this material next Monday in lab, some of you have already seen it. I'll just point to the page 6 of your notes that goes through the different types of white blood cells or leukocytes, just to point out some major groups and point out some interesting things about these cells. All these white blood cells can be broken into two major groups based on whether or not they have noticeable granules on the inside, granules being little specks on the inside. So for example, there are three types of granulocytes: neutrophils, eosinophils, and basophils. Neutrophils, you may not have seen the granulocytes in these cells under the microscope because the granulocytes or the granules on the inside are fairly small, but neutrophils have these more subtle granules. And the neutrophils were the most common white blood cells. These are the ones you counted the most of, or will count the most of on Monday, with this bilobed, complex-looking nucleus. And they're very sort of distinctive-looking. Eosinophils are the ones with these really red granules. And if you didn't see one in lab last week, we'll definitely get you to look at one in this coming week. These are specialized in attacking parasitic worms, which, you know, living in the United States, you might not think that we're constantly being attacked by parasitic worms, but it's quite common in humans, and we have a whole group of white blood cells that defend us against those worms. And then basophils, very, very rare, not very common. You might not have seen any of these. These are cells that release histamine and heparin. These are parts of your inflammatory response. We'll talk about these when we get to immune system. And then there are the agranulocytes, the two types of leukocytes that don't have granules, and these are the lymphocytes and monocytes. And sometimes hard to distinguish from each other. Monocytes are larger than lymphocytes. Lymphocytes come in two types, T cells and B cells, and we'll talk about them in a lot more detail when we get to the immune system. And then monocytes. Monocytes tend to be larger than lymphocytes, and they develop into what are called macrophages. A macrophage, a big eater, meaning that these are large cells that eat things, foreign bacteria in the body, dead cells in the body. They're sort of the trash disposal units of the body, these macrophages, and also look out for infectious agents in the body. We'll talk about those more when we get to immune system as well. Platelets. We talked a little bit about platelet production on Monday. I want to talk a little bit about their role here in plugging up holes in blood vessels or rips in blood vessels, and that's this process of hemostasis. Really, platelets form part of this process, so which is a three-part process. So let's take a look at that. The idea is that if a blood vessel has a rip in it, that there's a three-step process in decreasing the amount of blood flow through that opening and then finally sealing up that opening. And this first happens through a very, very quick response, which is a vascular spasm. And that's just a contraction of the smooth muscle lining the blood vessel. That smooth muscle contracts as a reaction to the local damage. It's not signaled by the brain or anything, but the local smooth muscle senses the damage in the tissues and contracts, and that's going to reduce the blood flow through that opening. And then platelets circulating in the blood can sense the rip in the tissue as well. Primarily the collagen that's exposed when the connective tissue around the blood vessel is torn. So this exposed collagen is dangling into the bloodstream. The platelets sense that collagen and stick to it, and they start to form what's called a platelet plug. And those platelets send out little extensions of their cells called pseudopods to reach out to the collagen and reach out to each other and start pulling each other together. And the platelets are very actively, not passively, but very actively plugging up this hole. The third step, and maybe the most complicated step, is the coagulation step, where the fibrin proteins that we talked about on Monday, one of the three big abundant protein groups in the blood plasma, go through this very complicated set of reactions, diagrammed here, to produce, in the end, something called fibrin. Fibrin, which is at the bottom of the slide on the right, fibrin is this mesh-like protein that produces this stringy stuff that you see in this scanning electron micrograph in between these reddish platelets. So the platelets are already plugging up the hole, and all this fibrin protein is forming this big meshy network, and between the platelets and the fibrin, that finishes up the plug and produces the blood clot. But notice how complicated this reaction is. All those ovals are different proteins involved. The squares show different cofactors, like calcium, for example, that signals part of this process. There are two pathways. There's an extrinsic mechanism. That means that the damaged tissues, the torn blood vessel, and the exposed collagen activates one of these factors called thromboplastin, and that, along with this factor 7, activates factor 10, and then goes through this whole pathway. And then there's an intrinsic mechanism where the platelets, when the platelets sense that there's damage because they've contacted exposed collagen, they activate factor 12, which activates factor 11 and 9 and so on. So I don't want you to memorize all these names. I want you to see how many steps there are and then look at the very end. The proteins I like you to think about are thrombin. Thrombin is a protein that converts fibrinogen to fibrin, the final step in this whole process. And something to think about is, why would there be so many steps? Well, I think this process is intentionally complicated because you don't want it to happen accidentally. Having clots form spontaneously throughout the body could clearly be fatal if it blocks blood flow in undamaged blood vessels. So as a fail-safe mechanism, this process is very complicated. Everything has to work just right for you to get fibrin at the end, and that's the way that the body assures that it doesn't happen at the wrong moments. So that's great. We don't get unwanted clotting. The downside is that if you're missing any one of these proteins, none of this process works. And that's what happens in hemophilia. Humans with hemophilia have inherited a mutation in one of these clotting factors, in one of these proteins. So one of them doesn't work. And if one of them doesn't work, you can't clot your blood. So hemophiliacs, which occur in the male population, occur pretty much only among males. 1 in 5,000 males has hemophilia. Can't clot their blood, which was fatal until scientists figured out basically how do you make these proteins artificially, and then inject them into people that don't make their own. So hemophiliacs have to constantly be injecting themselves with certain amounts of one of these factors, the one that they're missing, so they keep it in their blood, so in case they do rip open a blood vessel or get a cut, they can clot that and not bleed to death from fairly simple accidents. So here are all these factors that are involved. It's a reaction cascade and an amplification cascade, like we saw with hormone effects. A little bit of input produces a large output. Same idea here. A little bit of input, a little activation of factor 12, for example, will produce a lot of fibrin. Think about why that would be. It's a good review of the concept of enzyme amplification, and we can review that in class if we need to. You don't want to clot. Hemophiliacs have trouble clotting, and that's problematic. Too much clotting, as we said, is problematic too. And in wound healing, while it's great that we stop bleeding, these clots have to go somewhere. Sometimes those clots that form in normal wound healing can get dislodged and move through the circulatory system and plug up important blood vessels, and of course that's not a good thing. One way doctors can dissolve away clots is a very natural method, and that's to use medicinal leeches. And so this picture here, these are two medicinal leeches that have been applied to somebody's back around this incision, helping to break up the clots around the incision so they don't get loose and damage other parts of the body. And these leeches are secreting anticoagulants, which is the way that they, after they bite you, keep your blood flowing, prevent you from clotting, because they feed off of blood. So their saliva contains an anticoagulant which inhibits clot formation and melts away clots. And this is completely painless because their saliva also contains a naturally evolved painkiller. So you don't feel the bite, you don't feel them attached to your skin, and it takes the clots away. So why invent drugs to do this when we can use animals that do it quite well on their own? Okay. So let's talk about heart a little bit. And a lot of this is going to be review of what we did in lab, maybe put it into a little bit of context. I'm going to put it into a little bit of an evolutionary context for you, review some of the terms you saw in lab on Monday, and that will set us up to come back on Friday to continue on with a little bit more heart function. So what you saw in lab on Monday was that the heart is really two pumps in one. The left side of the heart is pumping blood out to the body, which is why the left ventricle is so large and the muscle walls of the left ventricle are so thick. It's the strongest chamber of the heart, the left ventricle. It has to pump blood out to everywhere in the body, and that is your systemic circuit, labeled here on the bottom of this figure. And the right side of your heart is pumping blood just to the lungs to pick up oxygen, and that's your pulmonary circuit. So the right half of your heart is sending blood to the lungs, the left half of your heart is sending blood to the body. These are these two pumps that we have going on at the same time, and this is referred to as double circulation. Now, it's a pretty complicated setup, and it's easier to think about these chambers if we look at how the system evolved and to look at different types of vertebrate hearts. So I want to walk you through three types of vertebrate hearts. A fish heart, it's a sailfish up on the top, a frog heart, and that's a wood frog on the bottom left, and then a mammalian heart, and there you have a little bunny on the right. So let's take a look at this fish heart. Nice and simple. Fish have a single circulation, meaning that instead of the two loops out to the lungs, out to the body, they have one loop to the body. Fish don't have lungs. Well, most living fish don't have lungs. There are fish that do have lungs, but most living fish don't have lungs. The sailfish doesn't have lungs, so they don't have a pulmonary circulation. So fish, typical fish, has a two-chambered heart, one atrium, one ventricle. Blood comes back from the body, goes into the single atrium. From there, it goes into a larger ventricle, and that muscular ventricle pumps that blood out to the body. On its way in a fish, it goes through the gills, where oxygen is absorbed, and then that oxygenated red blood goes out to the body, and then once again back to the heart. So one loop, the ventricle has to keep that blood pumping throughout the body, and it gets oxygenated on the way. Nice and straightforward. Amphibians, like frogs, complicate this picture a little bit because they have lungs, and they have a double circulation like mammals do. But unlike mammals, unlike human hearts, these frog hearts only have one ventricle. So starting again from the body, that deoxygenated blue blood comes back from the body into the right atrium, just like we saw in the human heart and lab, goes into a ventricle, out that ventricle to the lungs, now it's in the pulmonary circulation, back from the lungs to the left atrium, from the left atrium into the ventricle, and then out the body back into the systemic circulation. So looking at those crossed red and blue arrows in the ventricle, it looks like that blood would mix. This oxygenated red blood and deoxygenated blue blood would mix in that ventricle. But actually, the way that ventricle is constructed, these two flows of blood are fairly separate. But there is only one ventricle, so there's a little bit of mixing. But for the frog, it's not that big of a problem. The only difference in mammals is that ventricle is divided. So instead of having the single ventricle, we have the double ventricles. There's still a systemic circuit to the body and a pulmonary circuit to the lungs. The systemic circuit from the body still returns blood to the right atrium, into the right ventricle, out to the lungs. From the lungs, the oxygenated blood comes into the left atrium, the left ventricle, and out to the body. Once again, two pumps in one. A right pump that goes to the lungs and a left pump that goes to the body. You also looked at some of the vessels in the heart. And let's take our cadaver. These are shots from your cadaver CD. Peel away some skin, getting to those intercostal muscles and ribs, going through those to expose the lungs on either side, and the heart in the mediastinum. The mediastinum is the space in between the lungs. That heart in this picture is still wrapped in its pericardial sac, so you can't actually see the heart yet. It's wrapped up in a strong fibrous sac. If we remove that, we can see the heart with the apex pointing down to the bottom right. The base of the heart is what all the vessels are coming out of on the superior aspect. And you can see those vessels there, the vena cava, the aorta, and the pulmonary trunk. And let's label those. The vena cava are the large veins that return blood from the systemic circuit into the right atrium. The pulmonary trunk is the large artery leaving the right ventricle. The pulmonary trunk is an artery. It splits into the left and right pulmonary arteries. Don't confuse blue with vein. All blue vessels carrying deoxygenated blood aren't veins. The one carrying blood from the heart to the lungs is an artery, pulmonary trunk. It just happens to be colored blue because that blood is deoxygenated. The pulmonary veins, you can see two left and two right pulmonary veins. Let's flip that heart around and look at them from the back. So those left and right pulmonary veins merge together into the left atrium, returning oxygenated blood from the lungs back to the left atrium. And then, of course, the large, massive aorta carrying blood out to the body through the systemic circuit. And if we take a slice through that heart, here's some new stuff, so some new material for you to think about for Friday. That heart, as I said, is wrapped in a pericardial sac. Sac is called the pericardium. It contains two layers, and this is all review from last semester, the visceral pericardium and the parietal pericardium. And you should know the visceral pericardium would be the pericardial membrane that's on the heart itself. The parietal pericardium is the sac itself, lining the body cavity around the heart. And that pericardial sac contains a serous membrane facing the heart, secreting serous fluids to lubricate the heart as it contracts and moves around inside the sac, and a strong outer fibrous layer, which you saw on that cadaver. The heart muscle has three layers, or the wall of the heart itself has three layers. An epicardium, which is the visceral pericardium, the outer layer of the heart, is just the pericardial membrane on the surface of the heart. The myocardium, myo for muscle, the myocardium is the heart muscle. And the endocardium is the inside of the heart that's continuous with the lining of all the blood vessels. So the endocardium is an epithelial tissue that lines the chambers of the heart and is continuous with all the blood vessels. And then you looked at heart valves in lab, so I don't think there's much to say here other than to ask you to review their names and where they are. We have two atrioventricular valves that sit between the atrium and ventricle. Think about what they do. I point out to most of you that the left atrioventricular valve is stronger and more robust than the right atrioventricular valve. Think about why. And then those semilunar valves, the pulmonary valve and the aortic valve, are the flimsiest of all the four. Once again, why? So how does the strength and robustness of the valves, how does that fit their function? How does the form match the function? And this is something we'll review extensively next Wednesday when our guest speaker comes in to talk about echocardiography. We'll see lots of shots of valves in action and talk a little bit about valve pathology. So for now, if you can review your notes and look at Insight 19.1 in your book about valvular insufficiencies, what causes heart murmurs. And there's just a nice shot of those valves from different angles and a nice picture of those valves in actual heart on the right. And another figure from your book showing the flow of blood through those valves. And this would be also a great place for you to use your cadaver CD to look at the animations of this blood flow and get a good grasp on that going into Friday and Monday of next week. I think I'm going to end there. When we get back together on Friday, we'll look at coronary arteries and heart disease and what causes heart attacks. And then we're going to pick up with the cardiac conduction system. How do electrical signals pass through the heart? And then we'll do cardiac cycle. We'll look at basically putting all this material together, looking at the chambers and the vessels and the valves and the cardiac conduction cycle and how blood flows through a heart. And that'll set us up perfectly for our guest speaker next Wednesday. So please email me if you have any questions. Your quiz will be Thursday night. That's on endocrine system, so none of this heart material. That'll be on endocrine system. And then I'll see you in class on Friday. And please go to the website to see the new links that have been added there and some material that'll help you as you think about this these heart topics.